Okay, hello. This is the interview with Jasper Ford for the Festival Ideas. The first question.
Mm.
Could you briefly tell us about your books for anyone listening who hasn't read them yet?
I call them a sort of Swiss Army knife of books because there's a whole sort of mishmash. I suppose if I were forced to describe them as something, I would say they are fantasy books and they are stories about stories. I suppose what I try and do with my books really is kind of mining the collective memory that we all have. And whereas we were brought up with Humpty Dumpty falling off the wall and that's all that happens, what I do is I look at things from a slightly different angle and say, well, that wasn't all that happened. In fact, there's a lot more to the story of Humpty Dumpty than meets the eye. And it's the same case with not only nursery rhymes, but also the classics as well. So I like to sort of take the classics apart and see what happened behind the page, behind the words, and just sort of really look at things in a slightly different light. But essentially, I think I write fantasy with a sort of literary bent to it. But if somebody really hasn't read my books, there are two series, one of which is the nursery crime series, which is all about making nursery rhymes and nursery stories into crime thrillers, which they are. And the other series is about a character named Thursday Next, who travels into fiction. And there is a policing agency inside fiction. And inside the book world, it's all very real and problematic and bizarre and weird and fun.
I really like the idea of characters in your books going on sort of holidays and other people filling in for them.
Mm.
And I was just wondering, if you could fill in for one of the characters in your books, who would you fill in for?
Does it have to be one of my books, or could it be like any book? It has to be one of my books. I don't know, really. I sort of always kind of like to be Miss Havisham, I suppose. It's all the dressing up. I suppose Commander Bradshaw, really, because he kind of knows everything about everything and just sort of is there and as steady as a rock and, you know, sort of really safe hands on the helm. So I think he'd be quite fun to be, actually. Next question. Yeah.
When the story of your life is written, which it undoubtedly will
yes.
be, which plot devices will you need from the well of lost plots?
I don't know, probably the ones that give me a far more interesting life than I have. Because people tend to think, you see, that if you write sort of bizarre, fantastic books, and fantastic meaning full of fantasy rather than good. I think what a lot of people don't realise about authors is, in fact, we lead very, very dull lives. And for the most part, we're in a little room with a keyboard and a screen and ourselves making up silly ideas. I was reading a biography of P.G. Woodhouse, who I'm a huge fan of P.G. Woodhouse. And I was reading it, and I was amazed by what a sort of dull life he led for the main part. I mean, apart from, you know, the rather unfortunate events during the war, but for the most part, he just read and played a bit of golf and, like, took his Pekingese for a walk, and that was it, you know, which is disappointing. So anything that makes me interesting and exciting, I suppose.
We were wondering, kind of, because your books have got loads of amazing jokes in, and we were just wondering, do you kind of think of a really good joke and then go, ah, I better write this into the book, or does it kind of come to you as you're writing it?
Probably both ways. Sometimes I just have a really good joke and then I have to somehow fiddle it into the book, which is quite an interesting way of writing. Because when I write books, I tend to sort of set up three or four targets. It's like task week, you know. You actually set yourselves up tasks about how am I going to get a certain plot device into a book and then try and weave them in, you see, and then make them relevant. Because it's very tempting, if you have a good joke, to actually just write in the good joke, right? And then, but a good joke on its just standing on its own in a sort of, you know, empty wilderness is actually of no value. It's like a sort of bit of an exercise in empty cleverness. But if you can actually take a good joke and then weave it in, so it's actually an inherent part of the narrative, then it's not just a good joke. It's like a good joke with a reason for being there. So in the last Thursday book, which was First Among Sequels, I had this gag where I wanted a teenager to save the world by doing nothing, by like sleeping in the mornings. And I thought that was a really good gag. But I had to kind of make it relevant. So there's an awful lot of setting up to do and everything. But some jokes I just throw in because I like them, you know.
You mentioned Woodhouse.
Mm.
Are there any books or authors that really inspired you, that you thought, oh, I want to do that?
It's difficult, really, because when you're an author and you're writing a book and you read another book, and it's a good book, you tend to think, oh, I want to make my book more like that. So you're sort of constantly influenced by not only, I suppose, books, but also everything that's going on around you. So everything that's happening as you're writing the book suddenly becomes in the book. So books are very much of the time they're written, which is very interesting. I mean, Lewis Carroll has always been a huge influence. And the easiest characters to write for me are people like the Cheshire Cat and the Red Queen and stuff like that, because I know them so well, you know, and the way that the Cheshire Cat talks in sort of a series of sort of non-sequiturs and a rather very sort of relaxed, sort of distant kind of persona. I think the wonderful thing about Alice and you know, Through the Looking Glass and In Wonderland is that it's a multi-level book, especially Looking Glass more than Wonderland. And in particular, there's a chapter about the White Knight, which you can read when, you know, in your early teens or even younger, and it's just about a rather odd old bloke. But if you read it when you're, you know, later, late teens or in your 20s or 30s or whatever, it's actually an amazing sort of logical treatise on meta-language, because he has this long conversation about how words can have names, right? So a word can be something, and then a word can have a name, right? So my name is Jasper, but the name of my name is Pete, right? So the name Jasper is called Pete. So why shouldn't names have names? But then the name of my name is not Pete, it's Dave, if you see what I mean. So if you read the White Knight chapter, he talks about meta-languages in that way, which is very, very interesting, and the whole bizarre stuff. So what you've got is you've got a multi-level book. So he's writing for this huge, broad swathe of people. So what I try and do with my books is to actually try and write them so they're on a multi-level. So you enjoy the if you're in your teens or whatever, and you'll enjoy perhaps, you know, the great sort of fun and the jokes and silliness and a bit of action, a bit of this, a bit of that. But then once perhaps, you know, you've read a few more books, you're slightly older, slightly mature or whatever, you read it again and all of a sudden there's this sort of other section in it that you hadn't realised, and it's sort of just sort of underneath the text there. So I think that is a huge influence coming from Lewis Carroll. I'm not as good as him, obviously, but he was
history will judge.
Well, I don't think so.
So do you think that it's really important that kind of series books hang on to the element of sort of being fun and good to read, or do you think some books just have to be really serious?
Well, I mean, it depends what you read, really. It depends entirely on taste. I mean, I'll read anything that I think is good, you know, I mean, that holds my interest. And I'll read really silly books and rather badly written books, you know, if they're about interesting subjects. And I'll read quite serious books if, again, they're very interesting. You know, I'll even read books about economics if I think it's interesting, you know, which is really sort of pushing the boat out there a bit. I don't think books have to be one thing or the other. It's entirely what you make of them and what you really want to have in a book. You know, entertainment, a bit of thought-provoking as well. But I think the trick with trying to write a book that is all things, which is what we always try and do, of course, all the time, is to have a book that's funny on one side, and then it's a bit sad, and then it kind of makes you think a bit, and then, you know, and you get all these little sort of bits, you know, and just try and sort of tick as many boxes as possible.
On that same vein, is that sort of research for you, just reading whatever you can find? Mm. Or do you ever have to think, like, okay, I need to research nuclear physics today in order to work out about cold fusion?
Yeah, sometimes. The cuclear fusion, that was... I have a friendly physicist and mathematician, and I often send them a page and say, you know, you understand my books, you understand the way I will play with physics in a sort of rather sort of odd way. Does this kind of vaguely make sense to you? And he'd write back and say, yeah, that's totally okay. You know, you're using the right words, you know, not necessarily in the right order, but you're using the right words and it does vaguely make sense. So that's quite interesting. And then other ones, I suppose, about, I think I was linking coincidences with a drop in entropy, which and thermodynamics and everything, third order thermodynamics. But I figured that one out by myself. And someone who was a physicist said, oh yeah, it works totally, it's really good. And then there was someone else who said something nice about the boy band analogy about, you know, science being like a fashion, you know, just like a boy band. Just happens to be the way we're thinking at the moment, but the way we think, you know, in 100 years might be entirely different. So all that kind of stuff. And all that is sort of vaguely correct, I think. But I don't know, I just like sort of playing with maths and physics and science in a sort of silly way.
I know it's probably supposed to be kind of strictly classified, but you can tell us a bit about your about Shades of Grey, don't you?
Strictly classified, I could tell you, but then I, you know, you'd have to be killed. No, it's another odd book. The thing about the Thursday series is that it's very difficult to explain what it's all about, and you have to say sort of just read it, which is, you know, not very helpful. It's a sort of post-apocalyptic novel, but it kind of isn't. It's about a sort of new social order. It's a society that is not based on any sort of merit at all. It's based entirely on the colours that you can see. So people who can see, like, purple are actually, you know, at the top of the heap, and the people who can only see red are kind of at the bottom of the heap, and the people who can't see any colours at all, who just see in black and white, they're the sort of, you know, sort of drones of the collective. And the idea, of course, is to marry well, marry into another colour, up colour, so your children can actually move slightly on up the step. But, you know, you could be purple parents and, you know, little Jimmy, your kid, if he can't see enough purple, if he's a blue or something, then he's back down the heap. So it's a sort of totally unmeritous society, which has little problems of its own. But it's all about colour and how we perceive it. And how important it is, and of course how it's one of the most underrated senses, I think, that we possess. And it's just a sort of colour-based economy. It's rather strange. But, I mean, that's very basically what it's about. There's an awful lot more going on.
Post-apocalyptic sounds very Orwellian, or maybe even...
It does a bit, doesn't it?
But do you sort of see yourself in the same category as maybe Orwell or Swift? As like as a satirist?
Orwell and Swift, yes, only better. No, just kidding. No, I mean, satire is great fun to write. Two things really good fun with satire. Firstly, it's funny, right? It's very funny. Three things, actually. Firstly, it's good fun to write because it's actually very amusing. Secondly, it anchors your book in reality. Even if you're writing a very, very sort of fantastic book, if there are things which are very recognisable as the world that we have around us, and you can actually satirise things, you know, because there's a lot of satire in Thursday's world. Because Thursday's world is very much like ours, only more so. It's everything in our world is exaggerated and becomes Thursday's world. So you can actually then make Thursday's world very real, because I'm satirising things which are in our world. So it's very recognisable. And I suppose thirdly is you can actually then sort of counterpoint the sort of stupidities of modern life, of which there are many. And get people perhaps thinking about just how, you know, awful reality TV shows can be and stuff like that. So it's good fun. I mean, we'd all like to be, I suppose, you know, Orwell and Swift, really. I mean, I think that's what every author tries to do, really. But like, with more jokes. Or more jokes you can understand. You know, because all the Swiftian jokes are all sort of long forgotten now. They're all relevant in his time.
And you've used them as well. Sunbeams, yeah. From Cucumbers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, Journey to the Pewter, I think that was, wasn't it?
Well, thank you very much. This has been really very insightful.
Oh, you're welcome.